Now, as Boulderites, we like to claim Oak Thorn as our own treasure. But considering the positive international impact he's had on our Earth the past 70-plus years, we're learning to share. His Thorn Ecological Institute, currently known as Thorn Nature Experience, has been connecting youth to nature for over 60 years. He was mentored by many, and he continues the same in ecology, conservation, and the arts. The Boulder International Film Festival will be premiering the documentary on his life, rightly titled Mighty Oak, on March 4th. His 90 years are appreciated. I turned on the recorder and away we went. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Okay, well, we'll get on to some more serious things like your life.
Oh, my gosh. Pretty serious.
Yes, I know.
Pretty great, actually.
Indeed.
I must say. It's been a good journey.
Oak, I know you speak about your life is your career. Tell us about your experience being in Yale's conservation program in the early 1950s. How did the concerns of those days present themselves?
I think that program was 40 years ahead of its time. Dr. Paul B. Sears came from Oberlin to head that program. And today, of course, it would be called environmental studies. But back then, there was no such term, so they called it conservation. And it was very interdisciplinary, which was unusual. Sears really brought interdisciplinary thinking to Yale. And he wanted us to really be the same way. He required Yale to allow us. He worked it out so that Yale allowed us to take any course we wanted to in any of the schools, whether it was music school or law school or undergraduate Yale College or anything we wanted. Any course in the university we wanted to take would be open to us. He insisted on that. That just showed his interdisciplinary thinking. We had a very informal seminar twice a week. We never knew what the subject was going to be. It was totally a Socratic seminar. Dr. Sears would say, "What's on your mind today?" And somebody would say something, and off we'd go with a discussion. So it was really way ahead of its time.
Yes.
But I did learn from him the importance of activism, particularly political activism. He said, if you're going to get anything done in the area of conservation, you've got to get out there and be politically active.
Well, you certainly have proved that one person can make not only a difference, but it's kind of like the pebble in the pond, isn't it? The waves just keep going and going and going. And I guess I'm going to jump all over today because I had a question for later in the interview, but it feels appropriate now. And I would just like to say, I remember when my kids were here in school in Boulder, one of them was in Casey Junior High or middle school. And I was so happy when they instigated a similar program. So they got the history teacher together with the English teacher, and they all worked on things that just really fed into the other. And so here we were so happy about it, and yet you were doing it so many years ago already in Yale, but it certainly is a wonderful way to learn. And what were the concerns about when you were working in the conservation program? How did the concerns show themselves?
You mean just environmental concerns?
Yes. And what was the vibe of it all?
Probably the same way they do today. They just keep coming up.
Okay, yes.
And you keep attacking them.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
And through all these years, not many governments or businesses really have acknowledged the relationship between ecology and economics. What insights do you have to share about all of that? And you can look at it through the ages or from today, however you like.
Well, it really came through our first executive director, Betty Willard. She was an extraordinary person. And when she started to work with us, I said to her, just do whatever you want, be a catalyst. And one of the things she recognized was that business and environmental people needed to talk to each other. So she formed Colorado Open Space Coordinating Council. And today, that same nonprofit has evolved into Colorado Conservation, I think it's called. She had this organization meet with CACI, the Colorado Association of Commerce and Industry. So the business people and the environmental people were talking to each other. And this was in the 1960s. And the first thing that came out of it was having these seminars that we put on in Aspen, SEAS seminars on environmental arts and sciences. We jokingly invited the enemy. We invited Bureau of Reclamation, Army engineers, mining companies to come and learn about the principles of ecology. And they came and they did, and they got very interested in it.
I was going to say, how could they not, right?
Right. Well, as a result of our seminar, General Cassidy of the Army Engineers hired an ecologist and set up a National Environmental Advisory Board. And Charlie Luce, who was the head of Con Edison, the power company back in New York, went back and put conserve energy on all his trucks, just the word conserve energy. But the most interesting one is Stan Dempsey, who was head of AMAX, the Climax Molybdenum Company, which had really made a mess in Climax, Colorado, where they had a mine. They were about to develop a mine near the Henderson Mine near Berthoud Pass, and they came to us and said, after our seminar, and they said, would you help us develop this mine with the least amount of environmental impact? So Betty put together a group of engineers, and we called it the Experiment in Ecology. And really what it was the very first environmental impact study. And that was before NEPA was passed, the National Environmental Policy Act. So a few years later, when NEPA was passed, we were very happy that environmental impact statements were part of that. And we definitely had something to do with that, exciting to us.
Absolutely. And that's certainly one of the things, not unlike other work you've done with Open Space for Boulder, that has been the ripple in the pond that other folks have caught on to and caught on with. I know Rachel Carson was a peer of yours back in the day, and you actually were the first recipient of a Nature Conservancy grant. Tell us about that time and what that grant was about.
Well, that was when I was getting my master's in conservation at Yale. It was a two-year program, and in the summer between year one and year two, we had to go out into the real world and do a project. That was a requirement. So I went down to the American Museum of Natural History in New York and checked in with Dr. Richard Poe, Dick Poe. He was the author of the Audubon Bird Guide. I had met him my sophomore year when I worked for Audubon that summer. So I thought he might have a project, and I went down and I asked him if he had something I could do. He said, oh, I've got the perfect one for you.
I was going to say.
He wanted me to fundraise, pound the pavements, and see how much money I could raise to save the sunken forest on Fire Island. Well, I lived on the south shore of Long Island, and Fire Island is the barrier island that separates the Great South Bay from the Atlantic Ocean. The Sunken Forest was a holly forest, a very unique ecosystem. And it was being threatened by real estate, summer cottage development. And so he told me the names of foundations and directors and so forth. I had never done anything like this, but I went forth. And the first grant that came through was from the Old Dominion Foundation, headed by Paul Mellon, who was a Yale graduate. I think he felt sorry for me. Anyway, we got the grant of $15,000. But their director said, we can't give it to you directly, Oak. It has to go to a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. So I called Dick Poe, and I said, we've got $15,000, but they won't give it to me. It has to go to a nonprofit, tax-exempt. What's that? And he said, don't worry, we have one. 2 years earlier, he had formed a nonprofit with some friends from the Ecological Society to save natural areas. And it took 2 years. You had to operate for 2 years before you could apply for tax exemption. They had just gotten their tax-exempt letter from the IRS, and he said, we can channel funds through that. And so I said, well, that's great. What are you calling your little new organization? He said, oh, we're calling it the Nature Conservancy.
Just so, a little
so
blip,
the first
right?
grant to go through the little Nature Conservancy, and look at it today.
Oh, yes, they're doing fantastic work, certainly. And
they are. Betty Willard and I founded the Colorado chapter of the Nature Conservancy because when I was about to come out to Boulder and work on my doctorate in biology at CU, I called George Fell, who was the executive director of the Little Nature Conservancy. He had just been hired. I said, I'm moving to Boulder, Colorado. And he said, great, Oak, you can be our representative out there, like I was moving to the boonies.
Well.
So I was the first representative of the Nature Conservancy in Colorado. And the rest is history because they've got a big building a few blocks from where I live on Spruce Street.
Yes, yes.
As you know.
Yeah. You know, I was going to ask you how you see the environmental focus shifting over all these years, but perhaps the better question is, having founded the Thorne Ecological Institute in 1954, what was the focus then, and has it changed, or how has it changed through the years?
When I came to Boulder, the first thing I did was I was planning to make educational films, so I incorporated Thorne Films, which was a regular business, and Thorne Ecological Research Station, which was a name I had used when I lived in Long Island. I had no idea what we were going to do. I just knew that having learned the importance of a nonprofit tax-exempt organization because of that project at Yale, I just figured I needed to set up a nonprofit tax-exempt organization. So I set that up. And it took 2 years. We got our tax exemption. And then we grew enough so Betty, we were able to hire Betty as executive director. And she and I decided to change the name from Thorne Ecological Research Station to Thorne Ecological Foundation, and then we found that that wasn't a good name because people were calling us and asking for money, because if we had foundation in the name,
yes.
We changed it to Thorne Ecological Institute. And then about 10 years ago, we did a branding study and changed the name to Thorne Nature Experience, which it is today. But my golly, during the 68 years of our existence, we've changed and grown, and a good nonprofit should change and grow. It shouldn't just be doing the same thing. In fact, I got off the board in the 1990s because I had a chat with our executive director then, Perry Chickering, and she said, you know, it's a good idea for the founder to get out of the way because like founders can be problems, and they are. Sometimes. I had a lifetime appointment on our board of trustees, so I stepped down in the mid-90s and just became that was a good example of the founder getting out of the way.
Right, yes. It seems like teaching and mentoring has been the icing on your cake as a life well-lived. Would you share a story about how you approach teaching and mentoring?
Oh, gosh. That's a pretty broad question. I think that a good teacher is also a good mentor because a good mentor is a person that encourages young people. Very often young people need that sort of push, that somebody that believes in them to get them really going in life. As a matter of fact, you mentioned earlier about my life being my career. I learned that from a very wise woman named Anna Miller Tiedemann at the International Wilderness Congress, which was held up at the YMCA of the Rockies in 1987. Her nonprofit was called Life Career Foundation, and she said that she had run into so many young people that didn't know what their career was going to be. They graduate from college. I don't know what my career is going to be. And she would say, relax, your life is your career. And I just thought that was such a good concept that I passed that on to young people, too, to just relax and enjoy this incredible journey, which is your life career.
Yes, certainly. And having nature be a part of that is a great way to help in that relaxation, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I had an older sister who was wonderful with young people, and I think I must have learned by her example, and it just carried through in my life. I really enjoy being a mentor. I'm a mentor to 5 undergraduate singing groups at the university, and of course I've founded the CU Buffoons, which is the oldest a cappella group. In fact, this is their 60th year this year.
That's amazing.
We founded them in 1962. Don Grusin and I and Roger Nelson founded that, and 2022, that's 60 years.
Yes.
Later.
And you're quite a piano player as well. And I'm wondering, did you create original music for the film Mighty Oak, that is the documentary that's premiering in Boulder?
Yes, I did some improvisation, which is original. When you improvise, you never do the same thing twice.
Of course, yeah, yeah. Oak, tell us about bird banding. It's been quite a lifelong hobby for you, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, very much so, almost more than a hobby. When I was at Millbrook School in Millbrook, New York, I went there in 1942. That's when I banded my first bird. My biology teacher had a bird banding program. He had a master permit, and so he had students banding birds. 5 years later, when I was about to graduate and go off to Yale, he said, "Oak, you deserve your own permit if you'd like." And I said, "I'd love to have my own permit." So he wrote to the bird banding office, and since I'd been an apprentice for him, for 5 years under him, he wrote a glowing letter, and I got my own permit and had it ever since.
What's involved in that? What's so satisfying about it that you've kept it up all these years?
It's just exciting to catch a wild bird and put a band on it and let it go. You never know where it's going to end up. I find it's a wonderful thing. We have a course in bird banding at Thorn Nature Experience in our summer program. In the month of June, I teach bird banding to 12, 13, 14-year-olds. They have to be 12 to be in it because they need to be that old to have the coordination and be able to take birds out of the mist net or out of the trap and handle them. Such a wonderful hands-on activity for young people, and it gets them hooked on research. One of my former bird banding students is at Yale now as a graduate student in ornithology, and another one is a graduate student in environmental engineering. I'm just like a big kid. I still love catching birds and banding them. I banded tree sparrows yesterday. I chuckled because the first bird I banded in 1942 at Millbrook School was a tree sparrow, American tree sparrow.
Do you ever run into them again? Or?
Oh, yeah, we catch our own birds over and over again. One of the most exciting returns, or recoveries, I guess is a better word, was a yellow-headed blackbird we banded a few years ago at Sombrero Marsh. And it was caught a couple of years later down in near Guadalajara, Mexico. It's the first bird I've ever banded that was caught out of the country. So it's always exciting when one of your birds gets caught somewhere else. I do a lot of banding up at Abar A Ranch in southern Wyoming in the summertime, and I banded a female red-winged blackbird up there that turned out, 5 years later, turned out I caught her at Sombrero Marsh at our bird banding station there.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's a different version of message in a bottle.
Yeah, 2020 was the 100th anniversary of bird banding. The bird banding program started in 1920. It was started under the Fish and Wildlife Service, and it's a federal program under Department of Interior. it's under U.S. Geological Survey now, the Biological Diversity Division, but it's always been under Department of Interior. Mm-hmm. So you have to have a federal permit, and you have to have a state permit to be able to band.
Yeah. Did you ever get involved with messenger pigeons?
You mean carrier pigeons?
Yeah.
The ones that carry messages?
Yes.
When I was a boy, I had pigeons, yeah. They're just domestic pigeons like you see around the park. You're not thinking of passenger pigeon, are you? Because they're extinct. That's a wild species.
Yes, right.
There were billions of them when we settled North America.
Right, yes. A friend I had, he's gone now, but John Harold wrote a song about Martha, the last of those pigeons, and it's a very sweet song.
Oh, that's great. I actually found when I was 10 years old, I still do taxidermy occasionally. I was in New York City for 2 winters going to school, and my dad arranged for me to go down every couple of weeks after school to a taxidermist and watch him do taxidermy. And he had a whole bunch of birds and mammals that people hadn't picked up because he'd been in business, his father before him and his grandfather before him. And there was this one sort of glass dome that had dust on it, and I dusted it off, and I said, "Mr. Roland, you have a passenger pigeon." And he said, "Yes, my grandfather mounted that, but then whoever brought it in never picked it up." And then I asked him if he'd sell it, and he thought for a bit, and he said, "Sure, I'll sell it for $75. I was 10 years old. This is 1938. I'm 10 years old. And he might as well have had $75,000 because that was a fortune, $75.
Right.
Well, anyway, I told my mother and dad about it that night and that he had this passenger pigeon, but he wanted $75 for it. So the next time I went down there to watch him do taxidermy, I checked on the passenger pigeon, and it wasn't there. I said, "What happened to the passenger pigeon?" And Mr. Roland said, "Oh, a man came in and bought it." And I said, "Do you know who it was?" And he said, "No, never saw him before." Well, it was my dad. He bought it. And it was a big white box with a red ribbon on it under the Christmas tree.
Oh, sweet.
It's sitting on my piano here.
How does that fit in with environmentalism to be doing taxidermy?
Well, we have a lot of mounted birds at museums. You can set up some pretty interesting displays, dioramas that show a whole habitat. The Peabody Museum at Yale, they have several habitats. One of them is the Sonoran Desert, and then they have another one that's a habitat that shows an alpine environment, and they'll have the birds and mammals mounted in those exhibits, so it still can be used.
Yes. And it's wonderful now to see regenerative agriculture happening, and it's amazing once the soils start getting worked on and they bring the animals back to live on the land. It's an unbelievable equation that happens. Oak, what would you like to say in closing? I know you have a positive outlook on things, and regardless of how dire things are, I guess we could go back to one person can very definitely make a difference.
Oh, absolutely. I stress that, or any contact I have with young people, how important it is to be optimistic. If you're a pessimist, you give up. If you're an optimist, you never give up. That wonderful speech by Winston Churchill at a graduation, he just got up and said, "Never give up, never give up." One person can make a difference. No question about it. If you change the mind of one person, you've made a difference.
And what great forethought that your parents named you Oak. Of course, your full first name is Oakley, but the mighty Oak. You've lived up to your name, and the film that will be shown at the Boulder Film Festival, Mighty Oak, certainly will display a lot of your talents and your wonderful life.
Thank you. Well, I tell you, it's overpowering, really, to see that film. I'm very, very honored and very humbled by the fact that Pam and Christine did that. And they've worked on it for 6 years. So it's been long in the making.
The documentary Mighty Oak, co-created by Christine Anderson and Pam Hoag, will premiere at Boulder's International Film Festival March 4th, 2022. Find us at tributariesradio.wordpress.com and our podcasts in the usual spots. To honor Oak, and because I think he'll like it, I'm closing out today with that soulful song about Martha, the last passenger pigeon, written and performed by John Harold. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.
This is the story of the last passenger pigeon on Earth. Passenger pigeons used to fly in flocks of over a billion birds. They were all over this continent and into Canada and Mexico. If a flock was to fly over your neighborhood, it would literally darken the skies for a week or more. If they were to land in a forest or something in your neighborhood, when they would rise the next morning, it would look like it had snowed from maybe 2 or 3 inches of droppings. They were hunted for their plumage and their edible meat. By the end of the 1800s, there was only 14 left. And by 1914, there was only 2 left. They were in the Cincinnati Zoo, and it was a male and a female, and the last to die was the female, and they had given her the name of Martha. This is the story of that.
Gone.